Welcome to CoCurious, which is a community of learning professionals who are reimagining learning and financial sustainability. My name is David McLean, and I founded Learning Advisory to help academic and corporate education providers better balance learning excellence and their sustained financial performance. Our mission is simple: ensure that every cent spent on learning maximizes both the educational experience and an organization's bottom line. CoCurious provides an insight into this challenge and how we at Learning Advisory provide the support to address it. 2020 was one of the most creative and inspiring years of my life and my career. It exposed me to a working ecosystem that I benefit from every single day ever since. And the key architect of the experience was John Flismas. Why it was so creative was the quality of John's thinking and the speed at which he worked. Because it's one thing to have interesting, provocative, creative thinking. It's another thing to execute on that, to bring it alive again and again and again and again, especially in a high-pressure environment. So recently, I saw Player Zero, and John Flismas is the architect of Player Zero. And I read this, written by John: "Some leaders roll their eyes when I tell people they might improve the game by forgetting about the score. I encourage the cynical to stay with their resistance. It can be a gateway to awareness. Player Zero provides elastic glue for a dynamic culture and an environment for the wholehearted effort of people who feel good about showing up as they are." Tell us all about it, John.
Well, first of all, it's always nice to see you, David. And those are very kind words. So as you know, I've always been interested in bringing some of the abstract to the workplace. I have my own journey, quite a lot of difficulty with my own behaviors and obsessive stuff over time. I'm not going to use that tired phrase, mental health, because I feel like we now have all become qualified to claim things like trauma. We've become uber fragile. We've allowed the identity to reign supreme. We're watching people in things like gender identity disputes threaten each other with violence because they feel that the harm is so great that violence is justified. So while I'm interested in the identity, and that was my primary study, as you know, was understanding how identity forms perception or informs perception, that has a knock-on effect on how we form bonds of trust. And at that time, I think incorrectly, I put a lot of focus on identity because it's important. It's the suppression of identity that determines the volume at which it shouts. So we can't look at the identities as the only party to blame. You know, it's the very people who complain about the vibrancy of the Pride March who caused that volume, because they suppress those people's voices. So when they finally get a chance, of course you're going to scream at the top of your lungs, or you're going to sing as loud as you can because it's important. But what I've started to understand, and this is really through endless conversations, our conversations every day for over a year in the mornings definitely helped to inform them. Other people in my life, academics, because a process requires that I challenge what I propose before anyone else does. And then the very interesting idea of dipping a toe in a pool that's becoming quite unpopular quickly, diversity and inclusion, being given a hard time all over the world. But the point of entering that pool is, and I don't agree with cancelling DEI, that might be a dangerous move, to really go into this idea of inclusion, because it's not just identities that are important in the idea of inclusion. Equally important is the social contract, the glue that holds us together as individuals. And if we don't pay attention to that, so if we threaten violence to each other, if we cancel each other, if we stop talking and move to bullying, we've abandoned the social contract in favor of the identity. So ultimately, Player Zero is a player who has an identity, who is within the game, who is mandated to be in the game, has a purpose, has agency, but has let go of their relationship to the score in favor of looking after the game and the players. There's so much psychology, there is neuroscience, another word I don't like anymore because everyone claims to use neuroscience in everything they do. Humans are hilarious in the age of information. I know we've moved beyond that, but we now all claim to do things like research. You know, I've done my research and neuroscience, you know, having a brain doesn't make you a brain surgeon. Being of a particular gender or race does not make you a social scientist. Like, I'm sorry, it's not a high enough bar, but I understand that we've created that need by suppressing people. So I also understand the reaction, but there's plenty of research to suggest. And if you tie these things together, so treat everything as a game, you know, in some adult minds, that means belittle it or minimize it. I'm not saying that for one second. Games are complex, sophisticated, brilliant systems for human interaction that help us to understand interaction more carefully. So reduce things to games, understand the principles of gaming separate from game theory. Obviously, there's some mathematics that's involved there, but gaming principles, look at social identity theory, understand what contributes to what makes us who we are. We know that it has an absolute effect on how we perceive the world. We understand that reality is a shifting agreement between individuals. So Player Zero is a proposal of a leadership style that we can develop. It's evolving as I meet and talk to people and watch gaming principles play out. I work with clients. I meet with clever people, much cleverer than me. What I'm hoping is that Player Zero behaviors will start to emerge from the people I work with. We'll find them because I don't believe they're permanent. I think they pop up now and then. And if we spot them within teams and record them and reteach them, we will end up with a Player Zero approach that is extracted from the people who are currently leading and working on the problem. And we'll continue to develop it as we go.
With regard to the gaming principles, I think of gaming the system, a coercive manipulation for personal gain, or gaming as an activity around the desire to win. The human condition's propensity for winning, to be right, to get more. So can you define in the most lay terms what gaming principles are?
Sure. So you're not wrong, David. I mean, there are types of games. So that's very important to say. So one definition is quite difficult. It's got to be really broad. But a game essentially is any system of interaction between humans where there are a couple of elements. So there's got to be some kind of goal. Why are we playing this game? What are we trying to do? There've got to be rules to the game that define the game, because every game has different rules. So that's important. And there must be a system for when those rules are not kept. Otherwise, the game doesn't play out. They've got to be players, so that would talk to identity. What is your definition within the game as an individual? So this will talk to your strengths, weaknesses, those kinds of things, tendencies. There's got to be a map of some kind. The game plays out on a map. Now, not every single game needs a map, because we'll get to that. In certain game types, we need a map. We'll get to that part. But a map really is expected conditions and resources. And I'm keeping it really broad because we could talk about obstacles, but there are also opportunities on a game map. And certain things require certain resources. So that's quite important. There's a tie-in to resources available. If we take game characters following rules in pursuit of a goal on a map that have been defined, there will be interaction. And as a result of that interaction, there's going to be feedback. And the reason we call it feedback is it's not always the goal. We've got to figure out what other options are there for outcomes. For example, in soccer, every single soccer team is aiming to win. Only half of them achieve it, or they might tie. So this brings me to game types. If we play player versus player, a very simple game, then yes, there are three outcomes: win, lose, tie. That's it. Those are the only outcomes, which is an evolutionary directive in a system where you don't know how much you have resource-wise. So when humans didn't know how many resources we had, it's cool to compete. There's no problem. What's happened, and it evolves high performance, but high performance you could call an engine. So yes, a V8 engine is a very high performance engine, but it just burns an inappropriate amount of fuel. Yes, you will get the performance, and this is very important when talking to executives who are doing well. You are performing brilliantly. You're just the wrong kind of engine, because instead of burning fuel, you're either burning money, or you're burning people, or you're burning something you shouldn't be burning. So yes, you can carry on, but that's going to continue to be your issue. Increasingly, resources have become defined on this planet. Global temperature is one. Amount of oil. We can talk about electricity, but the bottom line is we generate it from burning fuel. So that's a stupid idea, unless we produce it from the sun. So there are some things that are more open-ended and others that are completely restricted. if we continue to play player versus player games, we will continue to pitch humanity against itself and we will burn resources in the race to win. If, however, we change the game to another game type where the map becomes more important, there are multiplayer collaborative strategy games. And people are playing them all over the world all the time. And the great thing about online gaming is that that behavior is being recorded constantly. So these new massive repositories of human behavior during collaboration are being built all over the world. The UK plays around 3 billion hours of games every year. And that's a lot of it's recorded. So what's coming out is that it is possible to play other kinds of games. But you're talking about going to the core of human wiring and changing it because the planet's conditions have changed. So we talk about things like value creation. That is such a potentially evil concept because in a closed system, there is no value creation, much like energy in physics. You can't claim new energy. You simply reassign it. So it's the same with value. Yes, your company can grow. You can make a gain. You can do something remarkable. You're in a closed system for all intents and purposes because most of the value we deal in is theoretical. So when we're talking about concrete value, you have simply shifted the value from somewhere in the system to somewhere else. Now, why is that value better with your shareholders than it was where it was before? And when you made that gain, if you're playing a multiplayer collaborative strategy game, you would have realized that your gain will come from somewhere and make some attempt to look in the system where the deficit will now sit. If we do that, and if we play a game where the goal is to get this planet to the end of the next year better than it was last year, that's our goal. You'll find examples all over the world where people have done restorative justice. They've done economic reform. They've done work on including others. They've done work on shifting people with no home into a new part of society. Now, not all of them have been catastrophic. There've been some really good examples that have worked. And what's interesting is this is not a new idea. It's been in Africa all along. African societies generally are multiplayer collaborative strategy games. Value gets shared more efficiently. There is better welfare for old people. Young people have got more variety in how they're raised because they have multiple parents, not one set of parents. You know, we talk about a family unit, but if your family's dysfunctional, you're trapped. So I'm just trying to mushroom us out of gameplay. When we talk about gameplay, we're not talking about video games. We're not talking about poker. We're not talking about anything like a Gran Turismo or Grand Theft Auto. Yes, those games have got a certain thing attached. The designers of those games are real architects, social architects. We just have to understand that there's something of deep value playing out in the gaming world. And if we don't learn from it, we're wasting a massive opportunity.
Let's take the archetype for-profit company that pays close attention to its competitors, the broader market directly within its sector. If they're a little bit more expansive and creative, they'll be paying more attention to other sectors, etc. And they have the traditional budgeting cycle. They measure their performance relative to the target as they go, and then as a summary at the end of every 12 months. So practically, how could an organization of that construct become a multiplayer collaborative strategy game participant / partner in a capitalist growth value creation winning world?
So as you know, John Nash contributed some beautiful ideas to the world. One of them is the Nash equilibrium. Now, this is used in reform already, but the concept broadly is that what you want is you want to try and encourage both players to play the best game they can, not deviate from their strategy because that provides a level of stability in the game, but play their best possible game. Now, this isn't a player versus player environment. What he illuminates gave me an idea that maybe it's not how we play the game, it's the game itself. There are a couple of requirements for a Nash equilibrium. The one is that the players should be playing for a more or less similar payoff. So this idea of someone winning everything and someone winning nothing is hyper-competitive. It's just a hard game to sustain. We want all our children to be Roger Federer. There's one Roger Federer on the planet at a time. So what we're really doing is selling our children a massive lotto And even Roger Federer generally psychologically will win. He will do everything, sacrifice everything to win, get a snapshot of success, and then not be able to reach it again, or looking at that snapshot feeling sad. So he doesn't live in the process on the way to it, and he stops living after the fact. So, and you can pretty much play that through with every human or corporation, because corporations are not immune. That they reach a point, every empire does. The universe doesn't allow, physics doesn't allow the holding of energy in one place for too long. So if the company hasn't collapsed yet, it's just a function of time. In fact, the more aggressively you assume power, the more rapidly you can lose it. It's just simple redistribution of resources. And the other thing is, in a Nash equilibrium, it requires that both sides divulge their strategy up front. If what I said about physics is true, you'll hold on to it for a little bit longer. I don't imagine that we're talking about building eternal value in a company. That's a bit crazy. But companies that identify a good goal, and they come up with that goal with their people. So in other words, the people have some agency in the design. And this is critical in Player Zero. Player Zero allows the players to participate in the design of the game. To a degree, obviously. Back to my suggestion earlier, we mustn't forget the social contract. And in a corporation's case, the social contract is the existence of the company. So while you can say my individual identity is not as welcome at work as I'd like, okay, but also remember that if this social contract called Vodacom didn't exist, you couldn't work there for the last 12 years. So it has given you something too. So we don't see it as the company's wrong and now we're going to start again with the staff. We figure out a way to give people voice within the existing social contract. That's quite important. So then you identify the goal. If you can identify the rules together or tweak the rules slightly, because the truth is a culture of a business is a living thing which should evolve. So it carries the DNA of the original founding idea, which is often what helps to keep it successful. But you allow for a degree of flexibility within the rules that evolves with each, let's call it generation. You will create players who are more invested in the game. It's not to say you don't achieve. You must have goals, you must have targets, you must have all of those things, but you can be a little bit aware of where that gain will come from and how to offset that gain. So you can take money and put something else out. That's absolutely cool. But it's the mentality of not grabbing all the time will make people feel more settled. Then identifying the skills of your people more carefully and allowing them to work in their specialty. So in a multiplayer collaborative game, if you identify yourself, the players, correctly, you will know what the special skills of each player. So in The Lord of the Rings, we knew what each of those hobbits could do. And they had a wizard, and they had an archer who was an elf, and they had, everybody knew their skill. That doesn't mean that they are cocky about it. There are times when their courage is challenged, when they feel insecure. We understand that. That's when the nature of leadership really comes to bear. And in that, leadership must be vulnerable first. Because in disclosing my agenda up front, I'm practicing vulnerability. Now, mutual vulnerability is not just hippie stuff. It's used when countries come together at the UN in order to argue. It's required that they practice mutual vulnerability in the process. So this is a very big thing. The Nash equilibrium is used in banking reforms. So these are major things. So you identify the goal. You figure out who the players are. You make sure you understand your people correctly, not their version of themselves that you would like them to be, or themselves being dishonest in order to protect their job. You have to work on the map with the players. So what is the road ahead to our goal? What are the challenges? What are the resources we have? And in this part, you start to identify novel resources. You start to understand obstacles in a different way because you have players who feel welcome coming to the party with different lenses. So what you build, this is Yuval Harari's work on intersubjective realities. You build a much more sophisticated intersubjective reality when you have the authentic input of several people from several lenses. This is why DEI is important. It's not about box ticking that the transgender person is welcome at work. That person brings an incredible novel view to the map. So, and also identifies resources across silos. So that's quite important. And then you start the interaction. Now, if you've done all that back work, your interaction will still be volatile. I'm not suggesting it's going to be easy. You're going to get bloody noses. Everything is like Fight Club, if you're being honest. Fight Club means sometimes you get a punch in the face and sometimes you throw a punch. What we've done is we've confused fragility with inclusion. They're two separate concepts. And we have to understand that there are voices, but they are fringe, who are causing a lot of noise. What we're aiming for is resilience as a team. not mutually exclusive fragility. That's disconnection. We build resilience by making our workspace, it gets vulnerable, but there's lots of support. And this is where Player Zero must come in. Player Zero needs to forget about their own identity and build that container for that volatile activity up front, so that when the team emerges, not everybody will make it. I understand that. It's not for everyone. Not everyone's at the right place in their journey to be able to do this. But they'll be more encouraged to do it if the container is diligent. And then you start the interaction. And then measure the feedback and see how close you get to your goal. And if you don't get to a goal, well, then was it the right goal? Or do we need to try something different to get to the goal?
Our mission at Learning Advisory is to help academic and corporate learning providers balance learning excellence and sustained financial performance. So if this conversation resonated with you, check out the other episodes on CoCurious. Visit us online at learningadvisory.com and let's keep learning, let's keep sharing, and let's keep holding each other to account for the advancement of ourselves and practicing what we teach.